Who needs an alarm in the morning when McDonald's has sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles and a breakfast cutoff? Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
This is the Yo Access Jamaica podcast, Reasonings with Odessa. Episode 27, it's all about the Dutty Cup.
When the beat drops, all the girls wanna sing along. Me, I go to give them the vibe till the kingdom come. The place where I come from be another dimension. Nobody will look my face when I day on my own. I've been on the road for a long time. Tryna get a breath so my family go survive.
Ugly, still I look for the beauty.
Yes, beauty, that's me. And this song is such a beautiful song. It's called Dimension. Big up J5, top producer, Grammy award winning J5. And it features Afro pop star Rema and UK rapper Skepta. And you guys can listen to more of this on my African Vibes OAccess Jamaica Spotify playlist. Yes, we're doing playlists now, baby. So, how have you guys been doing? How have you guys been coping during this pandemic? I mean, it's been really, really rough in Jamaica with a lot of lockdown and curfew and all of them things there. There's more abuse happening with our women, and it's just... Oh. But we have to, you know, keep going. We have to keep talking to our brothers and sisters, uplifting each other and listening to our women more and educating our men and our young girls. I want to dedicate this show to a dear friend of mine who passed away from COVID, and his name is Trevor Bailey. Now, I'm getting a bit emotional because I wouldn't be the producer or the production person I am today if it wasn't for Trevor Bailey. Trevor Bailey was the person that kicked off an army of careers for people such as myself, Kevin Lee, Ras Kassa, Nordia Rose, and if you're in Jamaican production, you would understand and know. So this episode is fully dedicated to Trevor Bailey. May his soul rest in peace. All right, guys. So this podcast is named Dutty Cup because I sat down with a dear friend, one of my dearest friends in the business, none other than the prolific Sean Paul. And I named this podcast from Dutty Cup to Dutty Rock because we talked about basically everything. Sean did not mince words. He did not hold back. And it was just truly an honor that I could have my brother sit down and we just have our reasonings and just talk about basically everything. So sit down and grab a cocktail and let's just rock and reggae with this one. This is Sean Paul, Reasonings with Odessa. Dutty-a. Reasonings with Odessa, and boy, I say this all the time when I have people on the show with me, but this Breda from like no other, Breda is one of Jamaica's most prolific Jamaican artists, producers, everything, somebody that I've known since I moved to Jamaica, and I'm happy to have you with me, Sean.
Thank you,
Edda. Dutty-a.
Hey,
one word. Yeah, man. So, Reasonings today is brought to you by Lady B Mixology. And cheers. It's a passion, a strawberry passion fruit kind of rum flavored mix up thing. But she's on IG, so you tangy need to go rum. And check her out. It's nice.
The tangy rum, you know, the freshness.
Refreshing. Sean.
Yes, ma'am.
How's your spirit?
Good. A lot better than a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. You know, a couple months ago, I kind of was down by all of this news about this pandemic thing and just a racial thing that we're going on in a big country like America, and you know, I really did lock off a couple months, at least probably 6 months, kind of was out.
Mm-hmm.
It's only after August I start, or September I start.
Come out.
Yeah, come out of my shell and go back to studio, and I've been very busy in studio since that.
You had a great 2020 though, mind you. How many hits did you put out?
I got 20 songs out, but I've whole it more now. So,
yeah.
But it's just 20 that came out.
You know, I've always wanted to ask you, when you're very melodic,
mm-hmm.
your sound has always been melodic. How do you put together, when somebody gives you a rhythm or you're producing a beat, how do you put that together?
It's a natural thing. It has to do with, I guess, what you listen to as a kid, and how you perceive music, which artists or which producers you love, and that type of vibe. So when I hear a rhythm, I usually hear the melody.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the times now, back in the day, I used to write the lyrics out or have the lyrics ready. Now it's just like I know that feeling, I feel the melody, and I start putting the words to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like the rhythm tells you what to say. So some of them want me to be emotional, some of them want me to be lovey-dovey, some of them want me to be more party vibe, some of them say talk about girl, weed. It tells me.
Mm.
But it's just naturally how I feel. And sometimes I do get confused, like I get more than one vibe. And
yeah.
If you kind of scratch your beard and say, I wonder which one now. So I've ended up doing 2 songs on one rhythm a couple of times.
Really?
Yeah, DJ Frass have 2 things for me a couple of years ago. One is called Give Thanks for Life, and then the next song is called Climb It, or I think Ride It, sorry. So one is a girl's tune and one is a more reality-based tune. But it's just what the rhythm tell me, you know, and I feel like the people going kind of tell me. People in Jamaica, or even on the internet, all about, they will kind of vote and say, like this.
Yeah.
So.
Did you ever know that when you got your first hit, what was the first song you did? That's the thing when I met you with
first
Jeremy.
First song that came out was a song called Baby Girl.
Yeah.
I was actually
in the studio when, I don't think you remember, and I was telling Jeremy that I was in the studio up at Jeremy Yard when he recorded that. And did you ever know that you were going to be so prolific once that song was out? Did you ever think you were going to be Sean Paul?
I can't remember voicing that and everybody going, yeah, and I love the feeling. But by the next day, I was like, how am I going to keep this up? I gotta go back with the pen. Because a lot of other people I knew had 5, 6, 7 songs ready for spit. And I had a few dub plates, that was cool, but that was my first single, and it was really a song that most people didn't know from me. So I started getting cracking in the studio now. Any rhythm that gave me a melody, I was like, yeah, let's go in.
Yeah, man. It was an instant hit in Jamaica. Instant hit.
And it's been a whirlwind since that for me, in terms of, you know, just people coming at you for rhythm, for song, for do song with them, for go on their rhythm, for shows, for dub plates, for just appearances. It's been a whirlwind. It opened up a whole heap of doors in my life. So music is something that I've always appreciated and loved, but it changed my life, as it does with so many people. So I see it as a blessing, and I just... I wish that everybody saw the blessings that they get from start, like, and cherish that as people, because life is hard. There's a lot of things that come that are in our way in terms of our goals and aspirations and thing. And music can free it up for you and a lot of people around you. So that's a blessing.
Jana, definitely. What keeps you so humble? You're one of the most humble artists, stars that I know. Aside from a Pupa, but you're one of the most humble people that I know. Like, you are on next level shit that most Jamaican artists really want to be at. And you're still Sean. You're still Sean that I know that used to carry Granny to the supermarket in his red Swift, little Swift. You know, you haven't changed from that. You're just still the same person. What is it that keeps you so humble?
I think that when I actually got into music, you know, when you look at people like Beanie Man, he was 9 years old or 5 years old when he started to actually perform for crowds. And that's a stage of development in a child's life, you know what I mean? So I didn't do that type of thing till I was 24 years old. At 15 and 17, I was trying to build beats and write rhymes, but I never took it serious and never thought that I would have songs out, really, and thought maybe I'd put out a song and just be like an anonymous DJ and people would be like, who that? But the ones that did that, it was like, yo, the who that them was very loud.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, we want to know this guy. You must show him face, like, let's see you. So that's really what started my career. But I guess I knew myself before. I was a developed person, you know what I mean? That's what I attribute it to.
You think it's the Capricorn in you?
Yeah, the Capricorn, the grounded mom, the bossy wife. I don't think that the crazy kids.
Yeah.
Don't think they keep me. I'm a brother too.
Yeah.
I'm very close with him. He's worked with me forever. Even when people don't see him, he is someone.
He's the man. Yeah, yeah, big up Jason.
Yeah, he's somebody who always been bouncing ideas off. I mean, we did share the same room till I was 25 years old.
Wow.
It was funny because I would come back from tour. Me and him come back from tour. And him have him girl and me have my girl and we in our bed and we're like, this can't work. Because on tour, he got his own room. Yeah. You know what I mean? So it was like, yo, this kind of mad, though. But, you know, that's just how it was in our family for a while and we couldn't do any different. But, you know, as I said, God bless me, man, and things. So he's been there from the first utterings. He was like, yo, that bad.
Mm-hmm.
And encouraged me. And then he got into a sound system with Copper Shot and Sean and Matty them. And from school days, they were playing at Sweet 16s. And not many people know that my aunt owned a disco called Sparkles Disco. And so that's been a part, like, I was carrying box from as a kid. They would have dances at my yard.
So people don't understand, like, the Uptown sound system vibe.
Mm-hmm.
They don't, but like, there's a lot of people watching right now and they just think dancehall is just country and a ghetto thing. Mm-hmm. They don't understand that we had dancehall and we had sound systems within Uptown communities as well.
Yeah, and we was the rebels in terms of a lot of society didn't want to see that happen, mm-hmm. didn't think it could happen. A lot of my friends who I would show my rhymes to say, yo, check out this baby. They're like, what are you doing, bro? You know what I mean? You know what I mean? And they would be talking about which college they're going to. And I couldn't see myself in that direction. You know what I mean? So it's a thing. It's a thing. But yeah, being, as I said, being an Uptown kid that wanted to do dancehall. And I wanted to be involved. And just wanted a song that people would say, yeah, bam, 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 to. That made me feel like, you know, I'm a little rebellious.
I think you guys kind of started that thing. I was in Clubhouse and I got on a Clubhouse talk with Jeremy and we were talking.
Yeah.
And it was like the Clubhouse room was about New York dance hall.
Yeah.
And I was just talking about, I was around when the rhythms that Jeremy was making and the sound that Uptown sound system and Uptown music, that what they did is that they coined a little different sound and a different vibe and made it into the whole vibe of what dancehall was happening in the 90s. And like Max Glazer and a couple of people were like, wow, they didn't even know that was how it happened because they don't really understand the culture of how we were, you know what I mean? The vibe that we went through when we were growing up in Jamaica, in Kingston, back in the days from...
We paid attention to everything that was happening in dancehall. And also what was hot in hip hop. And that gave us an edge because certain little words or phrases or certain things was like, you know, what? How him say that? And it just gave us an edge.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Kid Corrupt and Flo, people like Lugaman.
Mm-hmm. Dirty Cup.
Yeah, Dirty Cup.
You know, I actually called you guys Dirty Utensils.
Dirty Cup. Well, the cup was really a ganja pipe.
Ah, see, people know that. That's new.
A lot of people never know that. And I'm thinking, what do you mean by a dirty cup? And yeah, I mean ganja pipe. We were all weed connoisseurs.
All right, let's name them out first. So we're going to Dirty Cup.
So Dadigan, R.I.P. to him.
Rest he was in the peace, founder. Dadigan.
And he actually started a group with your brother.
Yes.
With Deanie.
Yeah.
And what name? Kill Cole's son, David.
David, yeah.
David Cole, who is engineer for the Marlies.
Marlies with Damien and yeah.
Yeah. And they called it, he was freestyling in the studio one day. And him said, like the dirty cup of make we burn down Rome. And your brother said, you're the bun. Yo, where you say where I go? He said, dirty cup, what you mean by all the cup, all that bad?
Yeah.
So the group was started without me or anybody of us in it. About probably a year passed, and a lot of Sandy Park guys got involved because it's Dadigan crew that, and they would go to parties and say, dirty cup crew. And then the link made at the studio with me going there to the dubs for Renaissance and Kapashat and the council. You remember them part of them?
Yeah.
Kimani them and Marcus Crawford them and Amayu there. You know, the whole link, the whole Campion, that was a Campion link. And they were the first people that came to me. Daniel Abbott came to me and said, youth, I hear say a DJ, I want a dub. I hear say you sound like cat. I want a dub.
Yeah.
I want to kill Renaissance. Went, so I went to that studio and started link with Dadigan. And you know, Dadigan was a big DJ in that camp at the time. People used to know him as Ezra or Borgia.
I used to call him Borgie.
Borgie, yeah. So him now start just befriend me, you know, as somebody who not from the same area as him. But then we woke up one day in Sovereigns, and he that's a supermarket. It's like a mall.
It was the mall.
Yeah, right at the hottest club in the world.
Mirage, I call it the Mirage.
Real thing.
Yeah,
the hottest club in the world. I still say it because that club had TVs on the ground, TVs in the wall, playing all kind of different videos while you're listening.
It was a light show,
up and down level, VIP, something, restaurant in there. It was crazy.
It was crazy.
So we start linking on the steps outside. And he was like, well, go on DJ. He was like the first person to call me DJ. And then he was like, yo, you know, Dini and
David
kind of not involved with the vibe no more. David want to produce.
My brother was doing him own thing.
Yeah. And so we did say, I'm saying, come in at the group, Dirty Cup, and we could do it. And he gave me the nickname Shanda Paul.
Ah.
You know what I mean? So I owe him a whole heap because he really, and I'm still in touch with him family to this day. Him daughter and him son, him brothers, sister and mom. All of them mean a lot to me because if it wasn't for his encouragement at the time, me being probably, well, I was about 21, and my mother looked at me like, what you do with your life, boy? And I talked to my little brother and I said, don't follow the youth, yeah. You know what I mean? Her confidence in me was becoming weak, and you know, my mom is a very big part of my life, so I was eager to prove myself to her. So at the time, I was doing UTEC, which was called CAS at the time.
CAS, yeah.
And I had wanted to get in for hotel management for architecture, but didn't have the grades. And then put me in hotel management. Say you can transfer if you have good grades after the first year. But 80 girl was in my class. And I was like, yo, I ain't moving from here. And, you know, by the third year there, my career was in full takeoff. And so the last exams I didn't do. It was just too much, and I said to my mom, I'm gonna do a year, and if that year doesn't prove to me to be something that I can contribute financially to the household, then I'll go back to the school. Because the first year of school, I had worked in a bank, and I saved up my money, 70-something grand, buy my book then, pay the tuition, go to school. My mom had to pay the second 2 years, and so she was very disappointed with me not finishing. And I said to her,
money back.
Yeah, I was like, let me show you. And within a month, I was making money.
Yeah.
And she was like, all right, go on, do what I do. But she's an artist and she was very kind of skeptical about me being in an artist type of life. Cause today I had to marry a not.
People. My dad had the same thing for his children. He's like, entertainment is
it's a crazy thing. It's a crazy thing. So she was very mindful of it and made me that way as well and thick skin at first. You know what I mean? I mean, I've had people tell, big producers tell people that, boy, Dirty Cup crew for DJ over at Thailand because beer shit will come out them mouth. And it was like, damn. That crushed us, you know, away. But with people like that, again, that's up.
He was always positive.
Yeah.
And he always came up with like the weirdest
little talk
slang and little talks. And, how the fuck come out your mouth, bro? You're like, boy, I always over this one.
That's why he was so fresh as a DJ, too, you know? And, yeah.
So how did we meet Luga and our boy
Massey
from
Kid, and Chicken. So Chicken was from Sandy Park. Dan Youth was someone I went to school with. He was a table tennis champion, or I was a swimming champion. And I had aspirations like him. I wanted to DJ, but when I saw him doing it at the Lizica parties, I would go to our 24 karat nightclub. I'd see him come up there and just grab the mic and show me the bop, and I was like, yo. I was like, I can't do that, you know what I mean? He gave me confidence too. So Kid Corrupt and him used to par. And Corrupt actually made it on one of the biggest jugglings I can remember. Poor people fed up juggling, fed up really, man. He had a song called, "Why Feel Feel Go on Pressure, Make a Girl Know You a Big Trendsetter."
That was the biggest. That's a big tune.
And then he had a hiatus for a year because he got in trouble. So when he came back, Dan Youth was kind of doing his own thing and touring a lot, and he was like, yo, and he started to roll with us. So that's how Corrupt got involved. So it was me, Corrupt, and Dadigan for a time. Luga, man, I know him from Third World. His pops is Richard Daly, and my father was very good friends with all of them. So I just knew him as a kid growing up. And also, Massey Kid, my father and his father used to swim together as kids, so live in the same community up at Mona. So
it was like a nice little Mona community. It was like Mona, BT, Sandyhurst, Nigani Mona, that kind of collection of everybody.
Sandy Park and Standpipe. And so the link started to kind of become stronger. And the look at Jack Seal Studio was the kind of the meeting place. And from there we started to say, yo, we could go mixing lab, we could go Buju Studio. Even before Buju had his big studio, now he had one called Cell Block 321.
Big up, with
Sil.
Sil, yeah.
So we'd go around there and I'd be a fly on the wall at the time. I mean, I'd sit and just watch Bean Man Voice, sit and watch Bounty Killer come outside. Them years at Bounty would just drink beer, Pepsi. You remember them years? And I tell beer story and everybody in the parking lot are listening.
It's just everybody around just beer jokes.
Beer joke.
And Bounty's a comedian. You don't really understand that. He is hilarious.
Trust me. Those who know him, you know, he's very, very witty that way. So and that's what a lot of DJs respect him for.
Yeah.
And I've respected him for over the years. Other than him doing breaking artists and thing, him just being the DJ himself. He's very talented in that respect.
Yeah.
Little sayings too and little jokes them way there. So I would watch Sly Billion Beats. And honestly, at those times, I don't think nobody talked to me when I went in the studio. I just go and stand up in a corner. Yeah. And just take it in and say, this is how people voice. And, you know, I remember watching it.
And it's a one-take situation.
Yeah.
It's not how it is today.
No.
It's if you don't get it right, you're going to have to pay for the tape, which was like $8,000 them days there.
It's a serious thing. So even Future Fambo said, one of the first recording he did, So he was telling me the story that at first the rhythm, they didn't press. Something happened with the rhythm. And that's why him intro was like, when the rhythm dropping was like, So, but he just went straight after that. So sometimes You know, them thing they teach me. You know what I mean? I was like, oh, so you have to be on point. So you have to know your tune inside
first
out.
First take.
Yeah, for the first take. From before you even record. It's not even dub plate. This is like, you know, because the studio time is being paid for. It's one producer. He might be, he's pressured by 20 odd DJs waiting outside. I mean, I also had the great opportunity of being told that I wasn't good enough by a great producer. Walk into the room and he's like, oh, you name so, I get your demo tape. Hey man, all right. And he looked at everybody in the room. There's like 19 DJs in the room. He say, you look tired, go home. You, your mother call you. You pressure the AC. You, your shoe them dirty. You mash up the carpet. You, all on, come out. And everybody look at me now, like say, oh, who done you tell we have run way out. I'm talking, there's a big DJ, right?
Wow.
So he only left Ancient Monarchy, who was known as Frisco Kid back in the day, and Wayne Wonder in the studio. And everything made him run the rhythm, which was a little bit the teeny weeny, little bit the man.
Yeah.
So me daddy and me a DJ. Everything that I DJed at the time was more conscious.
Yeah.
So me I say, it's an alarm, this is how they get a story. Read about it in the star and watch it. Next tune. Them did weep, but now them strong. And I was like, next tune. And I was like, damn. So I got you about 8 tune. I was like, you know, I like when the DJ pan slow rhythm. Come on, tell you. I was like, oh damn. I'm a fierce, like, tears swell up in my eye. Come and say, man, I need that, you know. I mean, this is how I look up to this dude as a great producer and thing. And he might tell me I'm not up to standard, so I had homework to do. Driving back. Steve Wilson was in the car, his management today. And he was like, yo, you all right, bro? I was like, no, dog, man, mash me up. Like, I feel like right now I should give the fuck up. Excuse my language, but yeah.
No, we could swear, but it's fine.
Yeah, so, but them little dues that were you pay as a younger artist, them time that I realize that now a lot of artists don't have to go through that.
No.
So to me, there is a, I mean, even with your dad's generation too, you would have to go and bleed. You see it in How Did They Come, you see it in the movie. Mm-hmm. And that was a true life depiction of what was happening in Jamaica. And it still happened up to the day when I was doing my thing. You have to prove yourself.
You have to pay your dues,
I think. Yeah, you wait. That's why I was telling people that I think artists, even though we are very narcissistic because we're always thinking about ourselves, the song, the video, the radio show, the, you know, everything. It's all about us, right? The pictures, everything you do. So, but even though we are that, we are also some of the most patient people on the earth, especially the generations before me and me, because for 50 people I line up and, you know, you're in competition with them and them outside talking and smoking with you. And the
remember
first chance...
Like, sometimes you don't even know how they get there.
Exactly.
Like, Craig T was telling me a story, like, he had $20 in his pocket one time, and if he didn't know if he was going to make it home or not,
yeah,
and he had to just hold on to that $20 while he's outside the studio.
Look, my man, like Merciless, you have to come from country.
Yeah.
And you don't know nobody in town. Even that happened to Toots. I was listening to a story where Toots told RIP to him. And he was saying, you know, he heard about... that in town was a thing, so he wanted to go there and then take a bus and come off in one place, and he must say, so this is town, and everybody said, no boss, I'm here paying this. And he have a revamp. Isn't it? But yeah, the most patient people, I mean, to be able to sit down and write out a whole song, then go and wait a turn, then when the pressure is on, you have to deliver, it's a pressure, you know.
So, now it's just digital.
Yeah.
Now it's just send me the song and me.
Mm-hmm.
But the old vibe of being in the studio, to me, still makes a song a hit.
Yeah, man. With people there.
Versus you sending.
With people there, with the whole vibe, the connection is much stronger. And the song, it probably mean even more to the artist after a while. You know?
Mm-hmm. So Dottie Cup came, went... And what was it that you blew up? Was it Get Busy?
It was Give Me the Light.
Give me the light.
Before that was Deport Them. So I did a song called Deport Them for Tony Kelly. Buck him up in the studio on Penthouse, and he was like, youth, You know, I said, me have a rhythm for you. You sound like Cat. I mean, him Tony Kelly, but I'm gonna say Tony Kelly, me know you, no, bro. You're crazy.
Why is Tony like that?
Yeah, cause he produced Get a Red Hot and a bag of songs for Super Cat, who's my father in the business. And I was like, yo, I'm ready immediately. So
before you jump into that, what was it about Super Cat that made you? Is it you can identify with the look? You can identify.
It was
the
sound, tone of voice.
The tone of voice.
Even when I was in school.
Yo, what's going on? Hope all is well. I'm Duke.
I'm Omar.
I'm Jalan, and this is Nice and Neat, the podcast.
We're three quintessential friends dedicated to the 360-degree development of men.
Our goal is to not only share our experiences, but offer as much value as we possibly can through the lessons we've learned along the way.
When I say we talk about everything, we talk about everything. Character, discipline, career development. Oh, and let me not forget, we get real personal.
Now make sure you subscribe so you never miss any of our episodes. Write a review, let us know what you think. Enjoy.
Cool at Ulma's trying to DJ on the desk, them DJ Shabatune. They were like, you sound like Cat. Go sit down, you sound like Cat. Oh, yeah. Yeah, like, yeah, DJ a major worries tune because I love this style. And he influenced Shabat, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
They were like, you sound like Cat. So there was that connection from the beginning. And every time I heard a Cat song, Super Cat song, it's a feeling. You know? And the first time I heard myself on a track, that feeling was there. And I was like, that's my way in the biz. I shouldn't try sound like Shabba or Eric. I don't have that big voice, that raspy voice.
You're melodic, though.
Yeah, more melodic, and the tone is kind of like mid-range to high tone. So I figured, I'd say, oh, and I respected the way Super Cat would have songs where it's about a woman. Then him have a next song where it's about life and him a cry for the youths. It was reality in his thing, and him was also
bad man,
rude boy, and also the ladies man.
Yeah.
So to me that was the flavor.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It wasn't all about being just bad man or all about just being a ladies man. He had a good mix of it. You know what I mean?
So you identify that with you. Have you always been the ladies man?
As a kid, as a youngster, probably.
Well,
I wanna be ladies man. At this point, Levi is more of a ladies man than I was when I was 3 years old. This dude I got girlfriends. He's him not easy. Yeah. So, but yeah,
Deport Them.
Yeah, Deport Them was one of the first hit song them out here, and then I remember that was 1998, and I remember in 2000 I went to New York, and I was with a DJ. We went into the club. We knock off the club and I came back into the car and we were driving. It was 2:30 at night, and as we turned on the radio, boom, 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 and he was like, yo, you don't know how big this is. And I was like, is this a fucking song I play up on the radio? And he's like, no, bro, it's 2:30 at night on a Wednesday evening. Dancehall don't play them time, bro. You're playing. I watch. And so that song blew up. And then Chillalala with Vegas also blew up.
Yeah.
And I put on my first album. Yeah.
Kevin Lee, big up yourself from Casa, yeah. Kevin.
Yeah, that was a monumental video for me.
Yeah.
Because the song was a hit song and...
But visually out of Jamaica...
Nothing was like that.
So I really want to give props to Kevin and Casa. Because they kind of changed the vibe of what music video looked like as well, locally.
And we wanted to portray the vibe that me and Vegas was fighting over the girls. So we're competing on the bikes. And we actually wanted to try do skydiving too, where we were like fighting in the sky. And they were like, Kevin and Casa were like, bro, what? We were like, maybe a football game then. And so then was like, the bike them is enough, bro. I go make it look crazy. And they did.
Yeah.
So it was a great vibe. And then, as I say, from those little things, I put out the album with VP. And then VP had sold probably 30,000 units for their biggest artist at the time. And this album went 75,000. So it was like, yo, it was an indication that this youth have a different direction going. And then they were like, next album. And I was like, all right. So, yeah, those were the first two tunes. And then Give Me The Light came. And Give Me The Light went not just to New York and Canada.
Global.
Everywhere. Yeah.
I think the visuals, and that was like the first time I've even seen you dance.
I want to tell you, the early years, I had a broke knee. Mm. And I'm not blaming it. I'm not the best dancer, but I can do my thing. You know what I mean? I can push my foot. But them early years, of like my first Sumfest in 1998, I got bad reviews. Yeah, the youth can't move. But a lot of people didn't know that I had one knee.
Wow.
And if you ever had a joint that doesn't work anymore.
Yeah. I have arthritis in one knee. Right now, my knee bent up.
And it makes it immobile. Like, just to move to right there, you have to kind of and do your thing. So it was something that I just knew that if I said, oh, but I have a broke knee at this time, people would be like, shut the fuck up, bro.
Yeah.
So but let's keep that quiet. And I went through. And it took years to heal.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was that, and you know.
It was over for that. It was like, I was like, fucking hell, Sean is Sean gone. Bumper clutch, Sean gone.
Give me the light. It was.
Give me the light. Dope.
It was dope. I remember the first treatment we got was me in the bushes with a chalice, and we were like, no, bro, we don't want to go that direction. That's typical at this point. So you can, what people don't understand about presenting your artwork, you have to know what's going on out there right now, so you don't actually be repetitive or boring in that respect. So I didn't want to be somebody with coconut trees and a chalice at that point.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I wanted to seem flashy, like even spaceship mm-hmm. type of world.
Mm-hmm.
So Little X was the one saying, all right, this is a dark room. You have a square on the ground. You reach and you don't see nothing, but you still step, and then the light lights up. We're like, yeah, that because that,
starting.
Yeah, that kind of, it was even reminiscent of how I felt at first. Like, where am I going with this?
Mm-hmm.
Am I really going in the proper direction for my life? Am I throwing my life away like what my mom might be thinking? Like, you know what I mean? So, because you know, just like with being a YouTube star now, you know, everybody wants to do it. But there's billions of competition, so mm-hmm. you might not make it.
Mm-hmm.
It was the same thing back in the day of being an artist. It wasn't so much that everybody can just kind of bust themselves by putting their stuff out on the Instagram. Mm-hmm. It was like, you're taking a big chance with your time in life.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to spend 2 years trying to be that artist and it doesn't work mm-hmm. for you. So that was a big issue in my brain at that time there. And, you know, we just pushed through and we just trusted in the feeling. I smoke my weed and people tell you, say, you're mad. Just trust that feeling there. So I'm not mad. I know what I feel. You know what I mean?
When you tour, because we're in a pandemic now and tour life has stopped, but when you're on tour, what is it that you miss the most about Jamaica?
The people, the food, just the everyday thing. You know, I just had a friend that recently moved away, probably 2 years ago, and they came back Christmas time, just before Christmas, do the quarantine thing, them come check me. And his wife was like, it's like, it's so sterile in America, you know? And I said, you miss the dirt. And she said, yeah. Because, you know, it's just a certain type of, you know, even though things do need to be fixed and cleaned up in our country, yeah. But there's just a certain sterility to that type of life that's in those big countries that it almost seems dead.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't speak to nobody, you mm-hmm. pass them on the road. You might love them shoe or them the skirt or chevron, but you kind of almost don't dare say nothing. Mm-hmm. It's only Caribbean people going like, yo, mate, see, look, go down your treads.
Nice, man.
Yeah, but like, when you live in foreign, you don't see that often. And so coming back here, she was like, boy. And it's the same thing for me when I'm abroad. It's the people you miss, the personalities, the
fact that people can just say, yes, DJ, on the road, and you just go about your average thing without fandom or fanatical craziness.
And just call you what you is. Yo, I go on Red Boy. It's no offense to me because
we're not politically correct.
We're just putting that out of the way immediately. We're going fat ass. And it's like, all right. They're calling you what you is. Or what you look like.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, them thing they miss, just the personality. And as I said, food and the place itself, to look up and see the hills, them and the mountain, them and.
We had that conversation, like, you could live anywhere in the world and you say there's still nothing like Jamaica.
There ain't.
Yeah.
There isn't. I've been to many, I've been over 120 countries on earth. 20 of them is African country.
Mm-hmm.
And I do love over there.
Mm-hmm.
And I love Tahiti. Tahiti reminds me of Portland, just a bigger version. The clear water them and things like that. But then it's just a difference in the people too. Mm-hmm. That it's not the same.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because I've traveled to the Caribbean islands, you go Barbados, and people not lock them grill. They don't have a grill. And you're like, what? I know a girl that went there for work. And she said she want to put up her grill them in the house where she rent. And they were like, grill?
What's
you mean
that?
Grill in the kitchen? And she's like, no, grill. Like, you know, for black old people. They're like, we don't have that here, babe.
That's you don't have more about that. Back in the day.
That, yeah, you used to go to sleep with all your door open. But things change, mm-hmm. you know. And even though it's not the same as then, when I'm away from here, I still miss...
I miss Jamaica. Yeah. Every time I leave, I'm like...
You know what I mean? Miss the little thing then. Like, for me right now, just the other day, I took a drive out to the country. I'm going to miss Fate's Pen, the old fucking
yeah.
Fate's Pen. I miss
the
it.
The smell of the food and
I don't care if it was unsanitary.
Yeah, I want the food and I want the grease.
Because right now, it look empty to me. Nobody stops in there. And that's a shame.
Yeah.
Things like that. The constant spring.
About Mount Rasta.
Yeah.
The trailer, is the trailer going to fall? Is it not going to fall? The Cremo trailer. One time the Cremo trailer dropped, I had like Buckingham orange juice packed
everywhere.
Up high on the back of my car going back
gone
to Gibson. Yeah, man.
But it's certainly good things. And even though with people who want to progress as a society would find some of those things you know, a drawback. When you do go away for a certain period of time, you miss not everything that's bad, mm-hmm. but you miss some of the dirt.
I miss the dirt. I miss the fuckery. I'm sorry, I do miss it.
Yeah.
I miss cussing taxi drivers until a couple of days later, I'm like back to like, no, I hate them all. I hate all taxi drivers,
yeah, exactly.
apart from my taxi driver.
Like, I just can't stand that people. Go on and pick up them dog poop. And
no,
and
like, that guy, that's what? Manure.
It's loaded dog. I'll make it wash away.
You'll wash away. Are we burn it?
It's so good. This is a different place.
What advice would you give your 20-year-old self today?
Let's embrace your life. It's going to be a crazy ride. And keep doing what you're doing. You know what I mean? I don't want to change nothing that happened in my life. The good and the bad times. The times my father went to prison or when my mother and father had a big fight on Christmas Day and he boxed her down and walked down the road and go and go take him coke. Them thing there was like...
That's crazy.
That was shocking to me as a kid. And, you know, people don't know we went through that type of things.
Now they just feel, say, uptown youth, you know? It's just uptown youth, man. Them have it easy. And
it's
not
every uptown youth. I've known people that kill themselves.
Uptown is just the area you live in. It's you could be uptown and live in a real fucked up situation, house.
And
you don't have everything in there, but you just live uptown.
I know kids who kill themselves because of their situation. Because growing up uptown sometimes, it doesn't mean you have money all the time. So you kind of feel like on the fence. Like it's like, oh, you don't belong.
Mm-hmm.
And I know people like that. And
I know people like that.
Yeah,
and
it's unfortunate. I'm not saying we're having it hard, like ghetto life,
mm-hmm.
but there is suffering as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so I feel that.
And everybody can have empathy. Once you know somebody's story and that kid in the ghetto, that kid growing up in the country, and that kid uptown actually talks, it's actually the same situation
it's
that everybody's going through.
I heard Monty Killer say once, him come to a dance in Narbrook, and him say, yo, uptown my blood clot. You know what I'm saying? The whole of Jamaica, one big ghetto. Everybody in there was like,
yeah.
But it's not as dire as in, you know, Waterhouse or places like that. But as I say, it's not everybody uptown is a rich kid that just takes trips to Miami every week. It's not that way all the time. So
I grew up with a celebrity dad and I never had to go.
Exactly. Your father worked hard for him and David.
Yeah.
And you know, there's things like that just I think those things kind of forged me into the diamond that I became. Because you're expected to be a certain way, and then when you're not, is that you feel like an outcast? You feel like, oh, I don't belong in any place.
But that's fine.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it makes you more unique.
It does.
Now that you're older, it makes you feel that I'm dynamic because I'm on both sides.
I know both
but
sides.
I would leave my private school and go to my council house, council house that I grew up in London.
Yeah, man.
And people were like, but you went to a private school, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, but I said, I have a balance. Mm-hmm. And for me, that made me feel unique. Yeah, always same way. A little.
Same way.
Yeah.
I had a sister, you know, Tommy Cowan's daughter, Sarah. She's a pastor. So, but she went to school with me at Hillel Prep School. Yeah. And she would leave there every day and go to Trenchtown.
Yeah.
Where she lived.
Girl, that's it.
And sleep on board bed and things. So people don't know, say, sometimes for your parent to send you to that school, which is most expensive, they sacrifice for that. You know what I mean? So when I was becoming the DJ of, it was obviously very, like, mind-blowing to my mom because she was like, look how much money I spend for you, got this up. And to try to keep you, you know, in your mind gear to do law or to do, you know, medicine like your grandfather did. But it just wasn't my thing, you know?
No, it's not your destiny. Mm. Your destiny was this, and this is your thing.
Yeah.
So, when you got the call to do a track with Beyoncé, what was that about? Or were you just like, it's just Beyoncé?
Tell you the truth, she and Destiny's Child opened for me at one of Kimani's shows.
I remember!
Up in...
Kimani's?
Temple Hall.
Oh, Temple Hall sides.
Temple Hall.
That was the first time I came to Jamaica.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So around them years. Yeah. So it was a show called Groove in the Hills, and they had one song out. At the time, I was a known dancehall DJ in Jamaica, and it was like, you're the headline for this show. So they opened for me back then, and I watched their progress. I always loved them, how them sound, how them look. I see one girl drop out of the group, and I'm like, what's going on? And then I hear that she's doing her own solo project in Chicago. And they were like, yo, would you do us? I said, fucking sure. She bad like what? So at first they sent the track. And I'm out underneath my mango tree in my car. And I DJ the lyrics to them and put it together and thing. And a mango drop out of the tree and drop straight in my lap. I'ma say that tune is sweet. Yeah, and I thought because it was her, it was going to be a hit anyway. But I felt a special little vibe, so I did a first verse, and then they called me and I said, "Come to Miami," and I went and did the second little part, and she was there, and she was way focused. I remember she walked into the room because I got there first, and she walked in the room and she was like, yo, come here. Is your cameraman there? I was like, no. She's like, who the fuck? She's like, yo, who sent that cameraman there? And they were like, them time that you never used to keep it a secret and then put out the word. But now it's like, yo, we are doing a tune. Yeah. We are doing a tune. So it was different back then. So she cuss off her record label, cuss management, kick out the cameraman, and then we get down to business where it was just me, she, and Scott Storch.
Nice.
And you know, her verses changed after I did my thing.
Ah.
And I hear so Jay-Z write one of the verses for her too. The one where I say, "Oh no, my baby."
That baby goes, yeah, that does sound like you though.
So yeah.
Yo, so that just took off. That was like a next superstar. That just kind of like, give me the light, and then it was just like.
Yeah, and it was very fortunate, and it was very cool that. Because dancehall was growing, but then when Give Me The Light did, it went whoop, and then everybody was like, what is that? I can't remember arguments like, my cousin, his wife is a teacher in Florida, and she called me and tell me, yo, these kids are arguing about you. I'm like, what do you mean? She said, some of them was like, that's new hip-hop, and the Caribbean kids is like, no, not a dancehall, you can't take that from me, and... And, you know, I had to tell her on the phone and say, yeah, tell him it's dancehall music. So it was that huge. It was a buzz in the States and in Canada and UK and those areas. And So she coming for me at the time just solidified it. You know what I mean? It was like, yo, she's a huge star right now. She's going on her own and she wants to work with this dude. And so they gave us reciprocal rights, which means she can put it on her album, I can put it on mine as well.
That's perfect.
So that was a win-win for me.
Yeah.
It was really cool.
And then you just kind of from that became the most sought out artist to have on anybody's track.
Yeah, it was.
It's a hit. If you put Sean on a track, it gone.
It was from then.
Is there anybody that you though would love, like you haven't worked with that you want to work with?
Yeah, I've wanted to work with Alicia Keys from the moment I was in my house. I go and turn on TV, I make a look at something, and I look up, there was no sound. I want to see this beautiful goddess looking at me and singing by a piano. I was like, who the girl? I'm turn it up. And I was like, damn, this song is crazy too.
Wow.
The first song that she had, right? So yeah. I was like, yo.
Falling.
Yeah, I was like, that is amazing, and I'm ready for work with her.
And so you haven't up to the... Yeah, it's true.
No, and me and Swiss Beats talked about it about 2 years ago. Him sent me a reggae one drop track. I was like, yo, I'm ready. Send me a track. And they stopped talking to me.
Swiss,
so I don't know.
Just talk to the camera and tell Swiss to say, one.
Nah, it's good.
So, just Alicia Keys.
She and I also had wanted to do one with Shakira for years. And if you remember the song Mad Love I did with Becky G mm-hmm. a couple of years ago, that was actually, Shakira was actually on it.
Oh.
And it was a dream come true. And I was like, yo, I've waited for 20 years to do a tune with you since 1998. And it's like 2016 now, it's almost 20 years. It was about 2018, 17 it was. And she called me one day and said, listen, I have an album coming out. And I hear you're trying to drop the tune now. And I was like, fuck. And it just mashed me up. I don't even think I look back on the phone. I think I threw it the phone. I threw it away.
I love Shakira.
You know?
I love Shakira.
I do love her. And, yeah. and you know, Becky G, when they suggested to put her in it, I was like,
yeah.
Because I met her when she was 13 years old, right? So, and I'm a big man at the time. But by this time, she's 21 now. Mm-hmm. But I was just like, still seems like a little girl to me, you know? But when I heard her, there was other people who tried it out after that. And I was like, yo, Becky, really, I do the thing. And she called us and said, if there's anything else we want to do. So it was one day I was in France or somewhere. And we didn't have Zoom them time, mm-hmm. FaceTime or something. Mm-hmm. While she in the studio, and I gave her the backups, ad libs to do. She was really on point. I was like, yo, this girl work hard, and mm-hmm. it don't make sense to take it from her. Mm-hmm. Make her do it. Ended up being a huge tune.
You've been doing so much. There's mm-hmm. loads of stuff. Like, you're the Latin artist now as well. Like, remember, everybody used to think that. He's not Jamaican,
I'm from Puerto Rico. No, he's Guyana. My family knows him in Guyana. I told him, bear that, when I go to New York or even Canada.
Everyone's speaking the Spanish.
Everybody's just like, yo, I'm not even speaking Spanish. They're just thinking I'm from their place. I heard you have Puerto Rican roots. No, from DR?
No.
Jamaica, come on and go.
Jamaica.
I'm like, why, bro?
Jamaica.
I did some of my thing there.
What do you want to see? What's got, like, okay. You had a recent thing in the media with one of our media houses.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that you want from media? I'm going to say it again. What do you want to see more when it comes to media and our artists? Because you said something and they took it totally out of context mm-hmm. of what you were saying.
Yeah.
It was a big thing.
Yeah.
And what? Do you think that media needs to be, our media locally as well, do you think they need to have, I don't know how I'm going to word it.
I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
But here is the problem. It can't be stopped because people want to sell them thing.
Mm-hmm.
Even people who just start up them YouTube channel, somebody come to the studio yesterday and said, yo, man, if I manipulate the place now, because he had a headline and we were laughing at it. We were like, yo, bro, what kind of headline that? It was just like, I just know if I manipulate it, if you get more views now. So it's always going to happen. So that's why I'm kind of...
So do you think that we should just start this with, we're actually dating, we're going to divorce Jody, and really we've been
secretly fucking. It probably would fucking work. But that's the thing, and that's what I don't like about the monster that we've created in terms of media. Now, media used to be, it's supposed to be.
Even the big publications, like I read Billboard, I read all of the big publications, they've dumbed themselves down.
Yeah.
And it's disheartening that now we don't have any proper ethics and codes.
That's the thing. The monster that we've created has no ethics, no code. It was supposed to be to edify, educate, just like music is. But again, everything is moving more to that way because it gets the clicks, it gets the tickets bought, it gets the people buying into or just even checking it out. So, you know, I even feel like people making up their little beefs sometimes around the place, you know what I mean? And, you know, it is what it is. I know that with the change, that it would be something to contend with my own morals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people used to be like bothering me to get on Twitter. Is my record label had to make, I was on a video shoot and they made a Twitter. They said, give me your phone. And they put it in and they're like, this is your Twitter now. I'm like, what? Because I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to be on the toilet and say, I'm on the toilet now. I'm eating ackee and saltfish.
That's not you.
No, and I mean, I said, Ching do it now, and him told me every lobby we go, our stadium for sound check, him just show everybody, and I'm like, that's really cool, because for him, he can show his crowd, like, but for me, I just don't think like
it's
that.
It's still like the illusion. I like the illusion of people not having to know everything about
you. Yeah, you know, when I was in Japan the first time when these little digital cameras just got small
What do you call again? I used to have one.
Everybody gave us one.
Flip camera,
right? So they gave us and they're like, influence people. I didn't use my own, but everybody in my group, my brother, Steve, and the BlackBerry thing and sticking pictures. And I was like, you are all not living right now, you know?
In the Matrix.
Yeah, you go home and you look back on it and you're like, that was wicked, but you don't feel the feeling. A bird just shit on your head, you never felt it. You know what I'm saying? Like, to me, that's how I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I get the whole being able to promote yourself. I get the whole being able to show people your lifestyle. But I just know that monster has been becoming more narcissistic. Like, you look on certain girl pages, just them face and them booty, just alone, just the whole thing on Instagram. It's like, all right, now, I like that. And so, you know, like, even when my wife would, I say, who you follow? Who them people are? I'm like, IG to me is just like Playboy or Penthouse magazine was back in the day.
Yeah.
I mean, you watch it. I mean, click on a little porn and check it out and catch our vibes.
Yeah.
That's what this is.
That's what it is, Max.
So I want people to know your son, and especially your daughter, them. That them I do. And it's just that monster of pedophilia, that monster of narcissism, is just getting closer and closer to a singularity point where we're not caring about not shit no more.
Mm-hmm.
So it is what it is, but I'll keep my morals and I will try to instill them in my son and my daughter as much as possible.
I will brought them up as auntie. All right, guys, thanks so much for listening to That Reasonings Part 1 with Sean Paul, Part 2, Dutty Rock, is going to be continued over on episode 28. So stay tuned for that. And until then, I'm your host, Odessa. Linkage Laters. Peace.
Who needs an alarm in the morning when McDonald's has sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles and a breakfast cutoff? Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.